All right, good morning, everybody. I hope you're all doing well. Some of you were at the concert last night, probably not doing so well. I did go. I made it through the end of the first set when they took a break. That was about 12:30, 12:45. I decided it was time for me to go. I was walking out. You know, I saw a whole bunch of you walking in. You were just now getting ready to start your evening. But it was a lot of fun. It's not every day you see you go to a concert where the lead guitarist is wearing a Rothbard Enemy of the State shirt. I expect all of the rock and rollers will start imitating that. You'll see that on Mick Jagger and Bono and that kind of stuff. It's so cliched, really. I mean, Rothbardian rock and rollers. But here we are. A little bit unhappy that I got assigned the 9 o'clock Saturday morning slot. I'm gonna have to speak to the executive director about that. Somebody's gonna have to lose their job. But I think we're gonna have some fun this morning talking about central banking, but in a slightly different way than we've been talking about it during the week, right? So we've already had a number of lectures and discussions about monetary theory and monetary policy, monetary history. Right? What the institution of central banking does in the economy, the effect that it has on the capital structure, how central banks create artificial bubbles that lead to the busts that constitute the boom-bust cycle, and so forth. So I'm going to assume that you guys are already familiar with the mechanics, with sort of the implications of central banking, why central banking is problematic in a market economy. This morning, I want to do something a little bit different and speak more about the institutions of central banking, to think a little bit about how central banks actually work from a managerial or organizational or governance point of view. I mean, governance, supervision, transparency, obviously these are major issues in the news. As we know from Mr. Snowden, the defense contractor, the U.S. National Security Agency, along with partners at other security agencies around the world, have been doing things that some of us are a little bit uncomfortable with. Okay? You know, mass collection of metadata, the ability to access the content of emails and phone calls and tweets and Facebook posts, you know, with a few mouse clicks. This, of course, has been a huge issue in the news over the last few weeks. Naturally, it won't surprise you that when these revelations first came to light, the reaction of the president was, hey, this is all fine. Yes, we do some of these things, but it's all strictly legal, right? And if you look at the, sort of the mainstream press, even some of the big establishment think tanks, they were quick to point out that, yes, the NSA does all this stuff, but don't worry, it's perfectly fine, it's perfectly legal, it's perfectly constitutional because, why? We have checks and balances, right? Congress was informed about the existence of these programs, by which they mean a small group of high-ranking Congress persons were invited to a private top-secret briefing about which they could say nothing to their staff members or their constituents. And presumably they were told, well, we don't know what they were told. One high-ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee said that the disclosure to Congress about the nature of the so-called PRISM program and other warrantless wiretapping and so on, that the president and the NSA have repeatedly pointed to as evidence that Congress was briefed, was like one page, three or four paragraphs. That was the disclosure of this program to Congress. And as I mentioned in a blog post a couple days ago, as a faculty member at a university, I have to submit an annual report on my activities, how many articles I published that year, how many courses I taught, what conferences I spoke at, and so forth. And my last year's annual report, I looked it up, it was 24 pages. So, this is for a complete nobody professor whose activities don't have a lot of, consequence. I have to fill out a detailed 24-page annual report on what I do. The NSA can come up with a one-pager on, programs like PRISM. But not only is Congress briefed, we're also told, we also have judicial oversight There's a secret court that kind of maybe operates like this one in Minority Report. You know, there are secret hearings where secret judges issue secret rulings on secret motions to gather information about you and me. Therefore, we have all three branches of government involved. We have complete and perfect transparency. We have, all the protections that we need against privacy and so on. I mean, we all recognize that this is, you know, a complete joke, right? The central issue involved in this kind of discussion is oversight, right? Oversight. It's one thing for the NSA to tell us, oh, we are doing this for your own good. It's one thing for the president to say, we must do these things to catch terrorists, to prevent terrorist attacks. We've already presented, 26 of them, but we can't tell you anything about them. Trust us. We have no evidence, no documents, no information that would confirm that anything we're saying is valid. We can't confirm it for you because then that would help the terrorists. Okay? We all recognize that this is a problem. There's a problem of oversight, or, as you might put it more colloquially, who watches the watchmen? Okay? If these guys claim to be our protectors, what reason do we have to think that they are, in fact, protecting us? I mean, if you've been following this stuff closely, there was just this past week, Representative Justin Amash introduced an amendment that would strip the NSA of the ability to collect the metadata. I don't know if you guys have followed this at all. I mean, and surprisingly, it was defeated in a fairly close vote in Congress. I expected it to be defeated soundly, but it was defeated fairly narrowly. But it's really funny if you paid attention to the way the president responded to this. I mean, the White House issued a statement denouncing the amendment, and the head of the National Security Agency convened a secret briefing with top congressional leaders, presumably to strong-arm them into voting against the amendment. But here's what the official White House statement on the amendment said the following. In light of the recent unauthorized disclosures, i.e. Snowden, the president has said that he welcomes a debate about how best to simultaneously safeguard both our national security and the privacy of our citizens. I.e., as Glenn Greenwald helpfully pointed out, we welcome the debate that we're only having because of this traitor that we think should be imprisoned forever, because of his actions in revealing stuff to us. And the president welcomes a healthy and open debate about a program the existence of which we've denied for years, details of which are completely hidden, you're forbidden from saying anything about it. And the president also said that the Amash amendment was completely the wrong way to go because it was a blunt approach. This blunt approach is not the product of an informed, open, or deliberative process. As Greenwald said, what a multi-level masterpiece of Orwellian political deceit that sentence is. In other words, the amendment was very precise and, surgical. It said we want to strip this specific provision from the FISA law that the NSA claims authorizes it to do all these things. And, what the president wants instead is an informed, open, deliberative process. Yeah, right. Right. That's exactly what the president wants us to have. Okay. What's the point about this? What's the point of all this? We're all familiar with these issues just in the last couple of weeks. We're thinking about transparency. We're thinking about oversight. We're thinking about governance. Well, when it comes to the institution of central banking, right, central banks in their own way are just as powerful, just as influential, and potentially just as dangerous as the National Security Agency. What kind of transparency, what kind of oversight, what kind of governance do we have with central banking in the United States, as in most places around the world? Virtually none. There's virtually no oversight of the activities of central banks. There's virtually no governance. There's virtually no transparency. Right? Now, most of us would say, gosh, I'm really worried about this NSA thing because we're giving these bureaucrats and contractors and politicians virtually unlimited power to spy on us. And if you want to go further, you know, unlimited power to drone bomb us and this sort of thing, right? So we also have the institutions in charge of monetary policy that have nearly unlimited, unchecked authority in their own sphere of influence, which, as we know, is an extremely powerful one, right? I mean, let's think for just a moment about what a central bank is. What is a central bank? Well, central banks are, they're government agencies or government bureaus. I mean, sometimes technically they're privately owned or quasi-public, quasi-private, but de facto they might as well be branches of national governments around the world. They have a legal monopoly on the conduct of monetary policy, right? Only the Federal Reserve in the U.S., only the European Central Bank is controlling, is dealing with money supply and so forth. In some countries, the central banks also either partly or jointly with another agency regulate the banking industry. In the U.S., both the Fed and the U.S. Treasury and a couple of other agencies are involved in bank regulation, but the Fed certainly plays a role there. They're usually headed by political appointees, right, and staffed by civil servants. So Chairman Bernanke was appointed by President George W. Bush and then reappointed by President Obama. Typically, the senior officials are, you know, technocrats from prestigious universities. Technocrats, right? But by which I mean, you know, people who are in principle non-ideological, but, emphasize analysis and crunching the numbers. I mean, Greenspan was supposedly, you know, famous. He was written up in the book Maestro and elsewhere as being this, you know, guy who just really knew the data, really had this great intuitive feel for the data. Of course, that was all a complete fiction. Bernanke was a very distinguished professor at Princeton University before he became chairman of the Fed. I guess he still holds that appointment. You know, nominally, central banks are independent of the polity, right? So even though the chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve System is appointed by the president, the chairman is not supposed to be a partisan the way the president's chief of staff or even the head of a cabinet agency in the U.S. is supposed to be, you know, from the president's party and loyal to the president and so on. I mean, Bernanke is presumably a Republican, right, but serving under a Democratic president. But again, you have independent, very powerful entities staffed by these technocrats with almost unlimited authority and discretion. I mean, if that's all you knew, right, what would you anticipate about the behavior of such an organization, about its performance? What would be the consequences of letting an organization like that loose on the economy? Almost unlimited power and no checks and balances. I mean, well, I would expect performance about, you know, like you would get out of these guys. And that's exactly what you do find. Let's talk just a moment about the Fed. Just as an example, if we looked at the European Central Bank or central banks in Asian or Latin American countries, we would find things not terribly different. So the Fed has these various mechanisms or instruments or tools that it can use to influence monetary policy. The Fed controls what's called the monetary base, base money, upon which banks, fractional reserve banks, make their loans. Federal Reserve sets discount rates, the rates at which the Fed lends to its member institutions. It sets reserve requirements, acts as a lender of last resort. We'll talk about that in a moment. And also engages in some regulation of bank lending and other bank activities. So, I mean, the Fed doesn't set the interest rate, quote unquote. I mean, the interest rates are set on loan markets, as we've seen this week. But the Fed, by controlling the monetary base, by controlling the discount window and so forth, is able to manipulate interest rates relative to what would obtain in a market, in a loan market, with the absence of a Fed. In the U.S., one peculiarity is that the Fed has been issued what's called a dual mandate. So the original, the Federal Reserve Act that was written, you know, in the 19-teens, gave the Fed the goal of maintaining stable prices. So the language that's written into the act is that the job of the Fed is to maintain stable prices. Of course, for an Austrian, that in itself is kind of an inside joke, right? Because what the Fed does is to inflate, right? Is to expand the money supply, cause prices to rise. But you know, the way it's sold to the public and sold to Congress and so forth is that if we didn't have the Fed, we would have rampant inflation, right? And Chairman Volcker in the 1970s, and then Greenspan, you know, late 80s and 90s, they developed these reputations, partly with their own, you know, PR staffs and so on, of being inflation fighters, you know, inflation hawks. And it's sort of funny, I don't know if you've been following the discussion, you know, Bernanke, it's presumed that Bernanke will not want to serve another term. There's a lot of debate, a lot of speculation about whom Obama might appoint as Bernanke's successor. And according to the rumor mill, the two leading candidates are Larry Summers, who is a very famous guy. He was Secretary of the Treasury. Under Obama, he was president of Harvard University, got kicked out in a sort of famous scandal. Other leading candidate is Janet Yellen, who was longtime president of the San Francisco Fed and is now vice chair of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. And some of the commentary, you know, about these two candidates is, well, some people are a little uncomfortable that, you know, both have reputations as inflation doves. Both have reputations as inflation doves, which is a polite way of saying that, you know, they want a really active Fed. They want to continue all of the, you know, they want to continue quantitative easing and everything else that can be done to expand the money supply and so forth. They're you know, serious Keynesians who want very aggressive Keynesian policies. But what's funny about that in a subtle way is the implication that other Fed chairs or potential chair candidates would be inflation hawks. Right? I mean, from our point of view, every Fed chairman is an inflation dove. Right? That's not even a meaningful distinction. Anyway, in the late 1970s, some additional language was added to the statutes. The Federal Reserve Act was amended to charge the Fed with achieving two objectives. The way some people read the law, there's actually a third too, but two objectives of maintaining stable prices, guaranteeing stable prices, and maintaining full employment. And if you think about this in the classic, you know, 1950s, 60s, 70s Phillips curve kind of way, the textbook Keynesian idea that the economy is always, you know, veering between two extremes, inflation, rising prices, and unemployment, and the Fed has to carefully manage this balance or trade-off. You know, stimulate the economy to make sure the economy is fully employed. We don't go into recession, but to keep the economy from overheating and prices going up too much. Of course, from an Austrian perspective, there is no such trade-off. That's illusory and is based on an entirely incorrect theoretical framework. But this language was written into the act so that now people say, well, the problem is the Fed has to inflate. When there's a recession, the Fed has to boost the economy. It has to pump money into the economy to achieve the full employment objective, even recognizing that there's some danger that might hamper the, you know, stable prices objective. And some people have suggested amending the law to take that language out. Some of the, you know, supposedly inflation hawk types in Congress want to amend the legislation so that there's only a single mandate, you know, maintain stable prices. Central banks are organized a little bit differently in different countries. In the U.S., the Fed is a sort of weird amalgam or hybrid, right? So you have, the United States is divided into districts, Federal Reserve districts, each of which has its own Federal Reserve Bank. And then there's the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, which coordinates the entire system across all of the regional banks. But the regional banks have a little bit of independence. And what's particularly odd from a political economy point of view, and this would be a great subject for a lot of theses and dissertations from you guys, is that the leaders of the regional Fed banks, right, like the San Francisco Fed or the New York Fed or the Kansas City Fed, the chair of the regional Fed is elected by commercial banks, the heads of commercial banks in that region. So the large entities that benefit from the Federal Reserve System elect their own regulator, right, who then reports to the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C. So, I mean, if you're familiar with Rothbard's theory of regulation, especially his work on the progressive era and so forth, Federal Reserve, you know, fits perfectly in to that storyline. Because, you know, what was the public was told that, well, the banks, these big capitalist money-grubbing banks, are out to harm you, and we have to regulate them to protect you from the banks. In fact, the banks were running the show all along. I mean, the banks wanted to be regulated, quote-unquote, by the Federal Reserve System. And it's pretty obvious in this case. It would be like, you know, if Exxon and Shell and Mobil and so on voted for who would be the chief energy regulator, people would think that was a little bit strange. But that's exactly the way it works in commercial banking. I don't need to say much to you guys about the Fed's recent performance. I would suspect I'm sort of preaching to the choir here. My remarks this morning are based on testimony that I gave at the House Financial Services Committee a year and a half ago, where the audience was not quite so receptive to this point of view, but I don't have to worry about it with you guys. You know, of course, from an Austrian point of view, the problem didn't start in 2007 with the collapse of the housing market, or 2008, Bear Stearns and so forth, Lehman Brothers, but with the credit bubble that was created many years before by Greenspan and Bernanke. As in its capacity as a regulator, the Fed, in concert with other regulatory agencies, of course, pushed hard to relax underwriting standards for mortgage applications, right? So, you know, again, using what Mises would call thymology, right, a thymological reconstruction of the boom and bust, from an Austrian point of view, would include, you know, two factors, right? You have monetary policy on the one hand. You have rapid expansion of the money supply by Greenspan and Bernanke, below market interest rates, the classic Austrian business cycle, early stage of the business cycle and the classic Austrian formulation, you know, but combined with specific things going on in the housing market, right? So the Austrian boom-bust cycle, Austrian theory of the boom and bust, is very general. Right, it describes the general outline of the boom-bust cycle, but to explain, you know, how the cycle is manifest in specific countries, at specific economies, in specific periods of time, we have to look at institutional factors too. Right, so in the 1990s, there was a boom in the technology sector, you know, internet stocks, that was partly fueled by credit expansion in the classic Austrian business cycle sense, but combined with things that were going on in the technology sector, the rise of the internet, which was a radical new technology that wasn't very well understood from a commercial point of view, and there were some unwise investment decisions made by, you know, venture capital firms and others about in public equity markets, right, investing in tech stocks turned out to be much more optimistic about how those companies would perform and what the business model would be. So that combination led to an asset price bubble in the technology sector in the 90s. In the 2000s, right, it was the combination of credit expansion and government policies designed to get more people to buy more and bigger mortgages, right? People take out bigger mortgages, and for people who wouldn't ordinarily qualify for a mortgage, to get one. There was a very famous study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston in the mid-2000s on what was alleged to be discrimination in the housing market, that members of certain underrepresented groups were not getting enough mortgage loans, and banks were pressured, not really in a subtle way, but in a very strong way, to make more loans to people in certain neighborhoods and certain groups and so on, who wouldn't normally qualify according to the bank's underwriting standards. So we have all these things going on, you know, contributing to explaining why the boom and bust took place in housing, especially in housing, relative to construction or some other sector in which it could have taken place. You know, then we get to 2008, late 2008, early 2009. We get TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program. We get the bailouts. We get the stimulus and all the rest of it. Right. Basically, what the Fed has done since 2008 is just massively expanding the money supply. I mean, at an unprecedented rate. I mean, an average of 33, monetary base went up by an average of 33.7% per year over that between 2008 and 2012. So it's a tripling, basically, of the monetary base, which is unprecedented, unheard of. And you guys already know this from other lectures you've had this week and stuff that you've read. Interest rates near zero, the so-called zero bound, people have been talking about this week. You know, from again, just to remind you, since it's Saturday morning, some of you are a little woozy from last night, right? The Austrian diagnosis, you know, if there has been an unsustainable boom, if there has been an artificial lengthening of the structure of production, if there has been malinvestment created by central bank policy, you know, the best cure, the remedy, painful though it may be in the short run, is to try to liquidate the malinvestment as quickly as possible, right? To get resources away from the activities that are not consistent with a structure of production aligned with consumer wants and redirect those resources into other activities, into other lines of production, right? Everything that the Fed has done, everything that the president has done, everything that Congress has done since 2008 has had the goal, implicitly, of preventing any correction that would have taken place, perpetuating the malinvestment as long as possible, right? You know, did consumers take out mortgages for houses that were bigger than what they could really afford? Well, the solution, according to the government, is to prevent all foreclosures, right? Don't anybody who has a loan must stay in their house that they can't afford, that's too big for them. We have to restructure their loan so they can afford it. You know, the idea of reallocating the housing stock, of moving people from houses they can't afford into houses they can afford, you know, and making those other houses available for people who could afford them and so forth. You know, that thought would never enter the mind of Mr. Bernanke or the president or anybody in government. You know, firms that had invested in production processes, lengthy, time-consuming production processes, investments in higher-order goods not consistent with the pattern of consumer wants we now recognize. The government doesn't want any of those projects abandoned. You got to keep them going. You know, whenever you make a mistake, keep making the same mistake even more. That's the Keynesian solution to the financial crisis. Okay, this is all well known to you guys. And as I'm saying, it's exactly what we would expect from an agency that can basically do whatever it wants. Okay. Now, sometimes in some audiences, when I have described and other Austrians, critics of the Fed have described the Fed as a central planning agency, we sometimes get some pushback on that. Right? You're all familiar with Mises' critique of socialism. We all understand the Austrian case against central planning. Now, oddly enough, most economists, even almost all self-identified free market economists, Chicago-style economists, libertarian-style economists who are not Austrians would say, yes, well, of course socialism doesn't work. Of course we need a free market. Of course we shouldn't have the government, you know, running the auto industry, and we shouldn't have bailed out Detroit, some of them would say. You know, you can see how well that turned out. But they would say, well, the monetary system is different. Of course, you can have a free market for tomatoes, you can have a free market for shoes, automobiles, but you can't have a free market for money and banking. That doesn't make sense because, you know, the monetary system is central to everything that goes on in an economy. Therefore, of course, the government has to define what is money. The government has to control the supply of money. The government has to, in some way, regulate the banking industry to make sure that it operates smoothly and so forth. I mean, it's funny when you speak to economists who give that kind of defense of central banking, you know, if you take what they say word for word and just substitute in the tomato industry or the shoe industry and read it back to them, you know, of course I would never say that for shoes or tomatoes. No, government's inefficient. Government makes mistakes. Government decision makers don't have the right incentives, knowledge. I mean, they'll give the standard spiel of why a government shoe industry would not be effective, but somehow they can't see that the same would apply to a government money industry or government regulated banking industry. So most economists say, no, what we have to have, even if we don't like it, we have to have a monetary system with a single kind of ultimate decision-making body, some kind of regulator who is in charge of the system. Can't be any competition in the provision of money or the regulation in the broad sense of the market of money. Can have competing central banks within a certain jurisdiction. That doesn't make sense. This monetary authority must be independent of political influence. I'll come back to that point in just a moment. But what that means is there's no oversight, right? So you wouldn't, for example, most economists would say, well, we wouldn't want to get Congress involved. We wouldn't want the Federal Reserve Board to have to, open its books to Congress, because then Congress would just run the monetary system, to get themselves reelected and so forth. You need an independent entity. The central bank has almost unlimited authority within its sphere of influence, right? So what I mean by that is the Fed does not have, at least as far as I know, which I may be wrong, I don't think the Fed has drones. I mean, it might, but as far as we know, the Fed doesn't have drones. It does have, paramilitary security forces, of course. When I was putting this presentation together the other day, I was looking for a good picture of the Fed to put on that earlier slide. I wanted something really ominous. If any of you have Murray Rothbard's book, The Case Against the Fed, the original edition with the white cover and the green lettering has this great picture of the Board of Governors building. It's like taken from below looking up. It's black and white. The building, it looks like a Stalin era 1930s, scary looking building. Anyway, but when I was looking for images of the Fed, I did find one I didn't use because the resolution wasn't good enough. It's this, sort of like the picture I showed you, but with paramilitary guys in front, with the Fed security force. And it's not like a little policeman with a policeman's hat. It's, the guys with M16s and full combat gear and so forth. Anyway, but my point is, I'm not saying the Fed, can run drones over Yemen, but within the sphere of monetary policy and bank regulation, the Fed can almost literally do anything. And what I mean by that, for instance, is if you look at quantitative easing or the Fed's so-called asset purchase programs, the statutes governing the Fed's actions specify that the Fed is only supposed to hold certain assets on its balance sheet, basically U.S. Treasury bonds. Treasuries, and for years, that's all the Fed had on its balance sheet was treasuries. But if you look at the language of the statute, there's a little escape clause. It's like the Fed is directed to have, low-risk securities, particularly U.S. Treasury bonds, unless there are extenuating circumstances. In emergencies, the Fed is allowed to hold other assets as well. And of course, as we know, the Fed has now been buying all kinds of assets, troubled assets, mortgage-backed securities, commercial paper, all kinds of stuff the Fed now holds on its balance sheet. And there's even talk of the Fed purchasing additional kinds of assets to hold. There's no restriction on what the Fed can hold as securities because of that language, that open-ended language, right? And again, this notion of, the technocrats being apolitical, right? And in fact, I know economists who work in the Federal Reserve System at some of the regional banks and at the Board of Governors. Some of them I know very well, my friends from graduate school or whatever. And, I would not describe any of them as ideologues. But, they're scholars and serious researchers, and they think that what they are doing is for the greater good of society. I mean, of course, they all have political views like anybody does, but they really don't see themselves as political actors. They see themselves as engineers. They're just running the system and fine-tuning the system to make sure it runs smoothly. I mean, in a sense, you might argue that's even worse than having somebody who's just a demagogue working in these kinds of organizations, because it's pretty obvious that all this person, I want my party to win, and that's all I care about, kind of like Krugman, right? Because you sort of know what you're getting. It's almost worse when people think they don't have any bias that emboldens them to do what they do, thinking that they're neutral and scientific and being apolitical engineers. Now, So again, the Fed is not a central planning agency in the Soviet sense of a central planning board that controls all resources in the economy, right? But the Fed is a central planning agency within its sphere. And I think it's fair to use that terminology. Okay, central planning within the sphere of money and banking. And of course, needless to say, that is a particularly important sphere in the economy. So it's not like we can say, well, it's a central planning board in the fertilizer industry, and we really shouldn't have central planning of fertilizer, but okay, it's not that big of a deal. No, this is money and banking, right? Not fertilizer. Okay, what's wrong with that? Again, I'm preaching to the choir here. You know, if you want to express it in sort of Hayekian knowledge problem terms, you know, what is the optimal discount rate? What is the optimal rate of growth in base money? What is the optimal set of regulations for the bank? I mean, who knows? Right? Some third-party bureaucrat is supposed to tell the bank, and in fact, this actually happens. A friend of mine does it. The commercial banks come to the Fed, their regional Fed, and they say, well, here's the loans we made last quarter. And the Fed technocrat looks at the loan portfolio. It's basically saying, no, you shouldn't have made these loans. You need to make more of these loans. How does the Fed official know? How does Bernanke know that what he's doing is appropriate, correct? Okay. There's the incentive problem, right? What's the incentive of civil servants to get it right? You say, well, you know, Bernanke has to be reappointed, or if he wants to be reappointed, he doesn't this time. You know, he has to do a good job. The top officials at the Fed, if they really, really screw up, they might lose their jobs. But come on, nobody loses their jobs. It's like the national security agencies, you know, after 9/11, nobody from the NSA or FBI, CIA, you know, was fired despite all these stupid things that they did. You know, the job of the Fed chair and the board of governors is to persuade the public and the president and Congress that they're doing a good job, which is, as you might notice, slightly different from actually doing a good job. Okay, and so everybody thought that Greenspan was the maestro, and everybody, Democrat, Republican, Independent, you know, except our guys, right, think that, oh, Bernanke's been pretty good, you know, it's terrible what happened in 2008, 2009, thank goodness we had Bernanke, otherwise we'd, you know, be living in trees now or caves or something. It's a public relations job. And ultimately, right, there's no market test of the performance of the Fed or the Treasury or whatever, right? Private entities competing in a market against each other, trying to attract customers through superior performance, have to make their customers satisfied or they go out of business, they go bankrupt. There's no market test for a bank regulator. There's no market test for a Fed chair. There's no market test for a Treasury official. There's no way to know whether what they're doing, no way to know the actual impact of what they're doing on the economy. So, you know, what do we think the Fed should do? What kind of structural changes could we make? Is there anything that we could do in terms of oversight, transparency, governance to improve the performance of central banks? Well, many economists have argued about various sort of incremental reforms. So there's a whole debate about so-called inflation targeting versus nominal income targeting. Right, so the sort of conventional view is that the Fed should decide, the Board of Governors should decide what it thinks the inflation rate should be. 2% increase in the CPI per year, 3% increase in the CPI per year, whatever. Of course, you know, it's a footnote. I'm not going to waste your time talking about why the CPI is wrong and arbitrary, right? But even leaving that aside, then the Fed is supposed to, you know, use all its instruments to try to achieve that 3% target. Others have said, well, that's not the right target for the Fed. That has some harmful secondary effects. The Fed should look at income-related aggregates rather than price-level aggregates. The Fed should say the growth rate in nominal income in the U.S. should be X percent per year, and the Fed should, you know, tighten or loosen, speed up or slow down, adjust its various instruments to try to achieve a particular level of nominal income or growth rate in nominal income. I already talked about the dual mandate. People said, well, if we would just get rid of the full employment part of the mandate, the Fed would be able to operate much better and they wouldn't be so soft on inflation, they would be harder and all that. But this business on hawks and doves, I remember many years ago going to a conference where there was a presentation by an economist who's a friend of mine. He's basically a free market guy, and he knows the Austrian literature, but he was at that time an economist at one of the regional Federal Reserve banks. That was his day job, and he said something like, well, this was a session on business cycle theory, Austrian business cycle theory. And he said, I'm so glad that I can take time, I can talk about preventing business cycles, you know, taking time off my day job of creating them, okay? So this notion that the Fed is smoothing out the business cycle when we know the Fed is creating the business cycle is a little more than a little ironic. You know, I mean, again, there are arguments that can be made in favor of getting rid of the dual mandate or not, or, you know, inflation targeting versus nominal income targeting, and those discussions are worth having, but they're really just trimming around the edges, right? They're tinkering with the system without making any, without really getting at the fundamental issues of oversight and governance, okay? Now, there are some more serious kinds of reform proposals that have been discussed, that have been proposed, right? The way it's sometimes described in the literature is the distinction between rules and discretion, right? So under the current institutional regime, the Fed has an enormous amount of discretion, right, to increase the money supply, to decrease the money supply, to change the discount rate and so forth, to try to stimulate the economy, to steer the economy. And many economists recognize that there are some drawbacks to giving the Fed that kind of discretion. So it would be better if the Fed had to follow strict rules. In other words, if the Fed's hands were tied where it couldn't take some actions even if it wanted to, that would be a more credible signal to the market, right? If you've studied game theory, those of you who have, you know about this whole theory of commitment, so-called credible commitment, sometimes by publicly and visibly tying your own hands, you know, limiting your own ability to do certain things, that can improve your strategic position because now people you're dealing with know that you really can't do that thing. It's like, you know, Ulysses and the Sirens or the army that burns the bridge behind it after it crosses the river and this sort of thing. People say, well, maybe it would be better if the Fed could commit credibly not to inflate by more than a certain amount, right? So Milton Friedman, a famous Chicago economist, argued that Friedman was in favor of a fiat money regime, opponent of the gold standard, and thought we should have government-created fiat currency, maybe by the Federal Reserve Board or maybe by the Treasury or some other entity. But the money supply, it should be, the rate of increase should be fixed by law at, say, for example, 2% per year. That it should be publicly stated and enforced in some transparent manner that, you know, the money supply, it's out of the hand, it's not under the control of the Fed or some government agency. It has to increase by 2% per year. Okay? John Taylor, a well-known economist at Stanford, a good economist, mainstream monetary guy, you know, developed a kind of a fancier version of Friedman's fixed money growth rate rule. So instead of just a rate, it's a formula, right? That if we have this publicly stated formula, you know, the rate of increase in the money supply should be a function of all these different variables, the unemployment rate and different aspects of the banking system and so on. You plug all these indicators of economic performance into a formula and it tells you what the how much the money supply should increase. So it's not a fixed rate of increase, but the formula is fixed. And everybody knows what the formula is, and so it's all credible and transparent and so forth. Well, I mean, most of us would say, look, if the concern is that giving the government discretion over manipulation of the money supply, the conduct of monetary policy is dangerous, you know, the best way to take that authority out of the hands of the government is to get the government out of the business of the money supply altogether, right? I mean, to have a gold standard or something like the gold standard. We talked about this in the upstairs panel yesterday. And again, you guys all know this. You know, it's not that Austrian economists are in favor of gold per se, but most Austrians are in favor of a monetary system in which the commodity that is used as money is whatever is chosen by the market. which historically has been gold and sometimes silver and other precious metals, right? But a monetary system that's completely independent of the government altogether. Right now, you know, the supply of gold is not fixed. There's mining and, you know, there's industrial uses of gold and use of gold for jewelry, supply and demand fluctuations. But the point is that the supply of gold that's available for monetary use is completely independent of the political authority. It varies just like the supply of any commodity on the market. Right now, you could say, well, okay, but in the short term, if we still have the Fed, could we implement some kind of a gold standard? The answer is, I mean, sure we could, because since, 1913, since the 1910s, we've had a number of monetary systems in which gold played some role in the governance of monetary policy, even with a central bank. And you could have government fiat money and say, well, each piece of paper represents a certain amount of gold, and the government can only print a certain number of pieces of paper depending on the amount of gold that is in the economy or the amount of gold it has in its, you know, in Fort Knox or whatever. But I mean, ultimately, what most of us would like to see is to get the government out of the money business altogether, right, and to have a completely market-controlled supply of money. Let me make just a couple of sort of passing remarks and then throw it open for some questions. One of the things that I find interesting about the current system is the way people view the chairman of the Fed. The chair of the Fed is, you know, not only has this unlimited authority, but it's almost kind of a demigod, you know, someone that, you know, you can criticize the president, say he's just a politician, he's a used car salesman, whatever. But the Fed chair is somehow different, especially under Greenspan. Greenspan cultivated this image, you know, of the maestro who was above the fray and so forth. But I thought it was very interesting when TARP was first proposed, a number of economists, including mainstream economists, were very much opposed to bailing out the banks, very much opposed to TARP. And they circulated an open letter that I think was published in the Wall Street Journal of, you know, mainstream economists in opposition to TARP. So Greg Mankiw, the Harvard economist, sort of free market libertarian guy who's pretty good on a lot of issues, wrote what I thought was a fascinating and extremely revealing little column on his blog about this problem. He defended TARP and said that economists should not have written this letter criticizing TARP. And here's his reasoning. Mankiw says, I know Ben Bernanke well. Ben is at least as smart as any of the economists who signed that letter or are complaining on editorial pages about the proposed policy. Moreover, part of the quote's cut off. Moreover, he is far better informed than the critics. The Fed staff includes some of the best policy economists around. The Fed's, in his capacity as Fed chair, Ben understands the situation. If I were a member of Congress, I would sit down with Ben privately to get his candid view. If he thinks the bailout is the right thing to do, I would put my qualms aside and follow his advice. Okay? This is transparency. This is democracy. This is decentralized decision making, you know, as it's viewed by mainstream economists when it comes to money, right? Basically, whatever, Ben, what should we do? You're smarter than us. You have inside information. You tell us what to do. It's just like the people who say, well, I don't know what the NSA is doing, but, you know, we got to trust them. They know more about terrorism than we do, and they're the smartest guys around. You know, they were smart enough to try to hire Matt Damon and Good Will Hunting, right? We just need to let the NSA do its job and not get in their way. That's exactly the attitude of Mankiw towards Bernanke. I wonder what Mankiw thinks of the NSA. There's a fascinating article by Johns Hopkins economist Lawrence Ball, which you can find as a 2012 working paper. He's trying to sort of understand why, at least in Ball's interpretation, which has been challenged by some people, Ball's interpretation, Bernanke in some of his academic writings advocated slightly different policies than what Bernanke has pursued as Fed chair. And Ball wrote this article trying to explain the shift in Bernanke's thinking. It's a very interesting narrative. He talks about one particular meeting at which an economist from one of the, I think from the New York Fed, Vincent Reinhardt, gave a presentation in defense of sort of asset purchases, and Bernanke went along with it, even though you would have thought he would oppose it based on previous things he'd said and written. And Ball spends several paragraphs talking about Bernanke's personality. He says, well, you know, Bernanke's kind of a shy, you know, nerdy academic, and he's sort of soft-spoken, and other economists were giving this presentation. They're very confident and assertive, and Bernanke just kind of shriveled. So, okay, fine, we'll go with what you think. And there was sort of, you know, groupthink among the key decision makers at the Fed, reinforcing each other's biases, confirmation bias, and so on. And that's why we got TARP. That's why we have QE and so on. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh my gosh, I mean, the U.S. Federal Reserve System is one of the most powerful government agencies in the universe, right? The actions of the Fed have a huge impact on the everyday lives of all of us. And, you know, what happens depends on the personality of one guy. If this one man had been a little more assertive and less shy, maybe we'd have a different set of policies that are governing your life and my life every day. I mean, that's what kind of a system is that? Is that the kind of system that we want? Of course not. A lot of economists, mainstream economists, you know, even if they're critical of the Fed, they say, well, but you got to have an independent Fed. Can't let Congress be involved. You can't let the public be involved. You can't have any kind of governance or oversight, because then the Fed would just do what Congress wants, not what's for the good of the people in the long term. I'm completely unpersuaded by this argument. Joe Salerno has a couple of a daily article and maybe a couple of speeches where he talks about how it would actually be better to have Congress in charge of monetary policy. Not that Congress knows what it's doing any more than the Fed does, but that it would be a lot more transparent. We would all know what the monetary authority is doing. And of course, we all think Congress is a bunch of buffoons, right? And we would be rightly skeptical, as opposed to having these highly respected secret guys doing it. The economists who champion Fed independence make several mistakes, right? One is they forget that the Fed also does bank regulation and other things besides monetary policy. The Fed, to some extent, is involved in fiscal policy. Do you want secret agencies doing that? And, you know, they don't, these defenders of independence, they don't do a balanced comparative analysis of the pros and cons of any system, right? Having a less independent Fed, you know, Ron Paul's initiative to audit the Fed or giving Congress a greater role in Fed oversight could have some drawbacks, right? That the Congress could make things worse. That's true. But there could also be some advantages, in that the decision makers would be constrained by public opinion in the way that they aren't now. And on balance, that might be an improvement. And I think it would be a net improvement, though, of course, it has drawbacks, too. Okay, so, let's see. Okay, we'll skip Mark Thoma's quote. Lender of last resort is a very weird thing that many defenders of the Fed, even if they agreed with all my criticisms up to this point, would say, yeah, but you need a government agency that serves as a backstop, right, that stops bank runs by always being there, standing ready to bail out failing banks. If we didn't have that, we would have bank runs, these cascades, and so forth. But, I mean, all economists recognize the moral hazard problem associated with having a lender of last resort, right? You know, those of you college students, if any of you is lucky enough to have a credit card, you know, where mom and dad pay the bills, or, you know, you have mom and dad pay the insurance on your car or whatever. I mean, you're not going to be as careful in watching your spending or taking care of your car as you would be if you had to pay the repair bills and pay the credit card bills yourself. So we set up a system where if banks, you know, if banks make a lot of money, they get to keep the money. If banks lose a lot of money, the taxpayers absorb the loss. Right, that's exactly what a lender of last resort does. It provides these implicit subsidies, and for heaven's sakes, these days explicit subsidies too. I mean, just literally putting cash in the hands of the banks. That's not an implicit subsidy. That's a pretty gosh darn explicit subsidy. You know, as opposed to competition among banks. You know, creative destruction in Joseph Schumpeter's terminology, where, you know, bank officials that make bad lending decisions would actually lose their jobs. Oh my gosh. Or banks would compete against each other for customers, and some banks would go out of business due to bad performance. Lender of last resort theory says we can't have that. because that would lead to a cascade or loss of confidence in the system, quote unquote. The whole thing is crazy, and I've got an article on this you can look up. People say, well, but you know, banks are closely linked to each other through derivatives, transactions, and other complicated financial dealings where if one of them goes, they're all going to go. It'd be this sort of domino effect. And that's crazy. I mean, in an advanced economy, every industry is closely linked to every other industry. I mean, the smartphone industry, right? They have distribution contracts with carriers. They have supply contracts with all of the input suppliers. They have cross-licensing agreements with holders of the different patents and so forth. You know, if Apple or Samsung were to disappear overnight and go bankrupt, that would have a huge effect on many different sectors of the economy. But nobody says we need a smartphone maker of last resort to prevent a devastating domino effect in the technology industry that would destroy the economy. So this argument is just silly. Okay, so to summarize, central banks are central planning agencies. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. You know, as I like to put it, central banks are run by men, not gods. Okay, we have to constantly fight this image. We have to break through this deceptive image that the Fed is above the fray. That Fed officials are like monks or you know, clerics. They're not in messy political stuff. All they're doing is what's in our own good in a neutral scientific way. That is an extremely harmful, you know, and sort of fallacious image that we have to fight and battle, right? And we must always engage in what Ronald Coase described as comparative institutional analysis, meaning we need to evaluate the pros and cons of various kinds of monetary systems as they would work in practice, right? So again, auditing the Fed, giving Congress a stronger role in monetary policy, just to give one example, that's not my ideal scenario, right? But that might have benefits that outweigh the costs, right? All practical institutions are imperfect relative to some kind of nirvana state. But we should always be comparing the benefits and costs of feasible systems. People will say, well, the gold standard, under the gold standard, you'd have this problem and that problem. You know, what if the miners start mining a bunch more gold? Then you could have an increase in the money supply and all these bad things would happen. Okay, I don't know about you. I'm willing to live with that, okay? Instead of Bernanke and Greenspan and TARP and all that, if I could get rid of all that and run the risk of these miners finding a big vein of gold. Okay, come on. That's a tiny, you know, tiny risk compared to the risk of the status quo. So don't let people accuse you. Don't let people say that your preferred system isn't perfect and let the conversation drop there. You point out that their system is highly imperfect too and that yours is better. So we have about 5 minutes for some questions. Yes, please. Yeah, I mean, without going into too much boring detail, you know, there are lots of different ways that a gold standard can be implemented. And sometimes what people have in mind by a gold standard is something where, well, you know, gold will play some role. It's not that individuals would use gold or gold-denominated currency units to make their everyday transactions, but that banks, that government central banks would use gold in their dealings with each other, right? That the Fed would store gold and the Central Bank of England would store gold and the European Central Bank would store gold, and gold would be used as sort of for clearinghouse transactions among central banks. And that certain kinds of entities, you know, there's a lot of different versions of this, that maybe large commercial banks would be able to exchange their base money into gold, that base money would be convertible into gold, but the money that you and I use would not be, and so forth. So there are a lot of different ways that gold could play a role in the system. And even some kind of loose gold exchange standard would be an improvement over the status quo, I think. But it would be even better to have a completely commodity-based system where individuals could make transactions using a commodity unit. I think this gentleman was next. Yeah, I mean, look, there's the question was about Bitcoin. What do I think about Bitcoin as a substitute for government money and government monetary policy. I mean, I'm not a Bitcoin expert. I know a little bit about it. I know that some of you are wildly enthusiastic about Bitcoin and probably know a lot more about it than I do. I mean, my understanding of the way Bitcoin works is it is fiat money in a sense, right? It's not a commodity-based money, but it's something the supply of which is independent of political manipulation. Under the current technology, well, sorry, let me say this. I would endorse the article by Nikolai Gurchev that came out 2 or 3 months ago on Mises.org about Bitcoin, or maybe it was a Mises Daily on Bitcoin, saying that Bitcoin does have some of the same properties as money in the Austrian sense, but isn't quite money in Menger's sense. Because, for example, it's not money in anybody's sense right now, meaning a generally accepted medium of exchange. So for certain kinds of transactions, an increasing number of transactions perhaps, one can use Bitcoin as an alternative to U.S. dollars or euro and so forth. But it's not what Menger would call a generally accepted medium of exchange. Maybe it becomes one at some point. Gurchev says that, well, technically, Bitcoin it started out as commodity money because some of the early people who wanted to use Bitcoin were doing it for ideological reasons. It was like making a statement against the government to use Bitcoin for your transactions, which has some utility value associated with it. So it's not a pure fiat currency in that sense. But bottom line for me is, Bitcoin is interesting. It might become money at some point, but I wouldn't call it money today. I think you were next. Yes. Yeah, so there's a question about fiat paper currencies that are paper currencies that are based on gold or backed in gold.
No, like say right now, like we have the current dollars, but we legalize gold and silver.
Oh, I mean, yeah. So the question is, what if we just kept everything the way it is, but legalized the use of gold and silver as legal tender, and you can pay your taxes in gold or something? Yeah, I mean, I think that would be an improvement over the status quo, and presumably in a system like that, government fiat currencies would be outcompeted and would disappear. So that could be a strategy or a mechanism for getting there. Guys, it's 10:03, so we need to stop, but we'll pick up with the next session in 12 minutes.